the milk and honey it a flow. You never can reap before you sow. All systems ready, all systems a go. Your scope must be wide and never narrow. The one Pharaoh, he was a stubborn fellow. But Jaja make him wobble just like a jello. And in a bandage, Joseph was sore. But the one that they refused became the Ekana. So give me the guava, banana, yam and afro. Red fruits, sour snap, and the mango. Then give me little cheese, it a me toto. Come me now move blind like mole in a wood. Boom, boom. Ball control, this and the ball control, hey. Ball control, this and the ball control. Me get it in the fence, go through the midfield. And give it to the striker and truth must reveal. Yes, I pop a culture up on the microphone scene. When me come and dance, I just red, gold and green. Open my chop on the mic and them know what I mean. Come in and the dance and the massive is king. Control, say we in control, babe. Control, say we in control, bow. Unfold, the drama unfold, one. Unfold, the drama unfold. You love that culture, me a bust on the mic. Bust on the mic until the broad daylight. Rock it on the left and we go rock it on the right. Bust it in the center till the morning light. Truth and reveal every time that we talk. Walk and we talk with your love in our heart. Anytime we come from beginning to the start. Come in and the dance like a poison dart.
Thank you. listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. Welcome to Ebony Spectrum and In Black America for another Wednesday.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
It's been phenomenal. Many times the agent who handles our insurances and things like this said, small companies don't give this much to people. And I said, I know. I understand what you're saying. However, you know, it's important to me to make sure that I'm at least competitive when I can be. Mm-hmm. And the experiences that the people have and the respect that I am able to get from them is just pretty phenomenal. You know, I know their families. You know, I see the pictures of the grandkids.
Right.
You know, we do things. It's just, you know, it's just been so far just a beautiful journey. And, you know, and back in 2008 and 9 when the economy really got really messed up, I don't, you know, I was telling myself, Jeanette, where have you been? Like, didn't you know this was coming? It seemed to just knock me upside my head. All of a sudden, things were horrible, you know, and I was like, what the heck?
Jeanette Abraham, founder, president, and CEO of JMA Global LLC, a 100% minority and woman-owned company. Abraham spent the majority of her career working for General Motors Corporation from the time she was a 16-year-old co-op student attending Pershing High School in Detroit, Michigan. It was there where she was nurtured and earned both her undergraduate and graduate degrees. She spent many years in leadership roles as part of GM's management team. In 2000, Abraham purchased a 51% ownership in Detroit Heavy, a supplier of fasteners such as bolts and screws to the automotive industry. In 2001, she founded JMA Logistics, a multi-million dollar Tier 1 Detroit automotive supplier. Abraham is one of the top 10 African-American female entrepreneurs in the country. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, JMA Global, LLC, with founder, president, and CEO Jeanette Abraham, In Black America.
One day I went out, I took a vacation day, and I went to Ford Motor, the Wixom facility and procurement there. They had a director position open, and I wanted to go and interview for it. And so I took a day off, and I went, and then I came back to work the next day, and somehow or another the director of my department found out that I was on an interview. And so, you know, his secretary called me in, and so she says, you know, Mr. Thompson would like to see you. And I'm thinking, what the heck does he want to see me for? So I go in there, and, you know, this is what we used to call Mahogany Row. It was like all wood walls is where all the big shots sat. Mm-hmm. They had little buttons by their desk, and so you could come in, and they would push the button to close the door. Nobody had to get up. And so I sat there and I looked at him. I said, so what can I do for you today? He says, well, I hear you think Ford has a better idea. And I just bust out laughing. I said, how did you know? I said, I was on my own time on vacation. He said, yes, I know. But, you know, we want you to stay. And we don't want you to take any other position because we have plans for you. And so I was like, okay, cool.
Indeed, General Motors Corporation had big plans for Jeanette Abraham. Born and raised in Detroit, Michigan, her father worked a second shift at Chrysler, and her mother stayed home raising her and her three sisters. At the age of 16, she was attending John J. Pershing High School, participating in a co-op program with General Motors. When she joined the co-op program, she only had to take three buses, but the family moved to the west side of the city, which required her to take 9 buses to get to General Motors. Abraham spent 32 years with General Motors. She spent many years in leadership roles as part of GM's management team. She was a purchasing manager of worldwide fasteners for North American operations at GM. She decided which companies would get GM business. In 2000, she stepped out on her own and bought a controlling interest in Detroit Heavy. In 2001, Abraham founded JMA Global LLC, a Tier 1 supplier to the automotive industry. Recently, In Black America spoke with Jeanette Abraham.
Well, you know, I grew up on the north end of Detroit, a lovely neighborhood. Everybody knew each other. We were in and out of the neighbors' homes. we had to be home when the street light came on. So you had to be noticed and where are you? But I had a lovely childhood. I have three sisters and no brothers at all. And, you know, we just enjoyed living up. I have quite a good memory of the neighborhood.
I understand that your father worked the second shift at Chrysler?
Yes, he worked at Chrysler on the second shift. And my mom was a stay-at-home mother. And ironically, she was so funny. We couldn't go anywhere or do anything unless we had talked to Dad first, because she was home while he was at work, and if you thought you could play one against the other, then you really got punished. You couldn't go anywhere. And the answer was always, well, what did your mother say or what did your dad say? Because they wanted to support one another. So we were very, very family oriented. Oftentimes my aunts and uncles and cousins were always over, and, you know, my family would play cards. My mom would cook, and they'd be over like all hours, just playing cards, having a good time, and eating, and just being very, very family oriented. So I have fond memories of doing things with family because we were very family focused.
Now, when I attended Pershing, the feeder junior high was Cleveland. What junior high did you attend?
Cleveland, same one.
Same one. Okay. And I graduated in 68, but you became a freshman in 68 or 69?
I graduated in 69.
Okay. And tell us about the co-op program that you were a participant in.
So amazing. So I had a great co-op teacher. There were two of them, Mrs. Newber
mm-hmm.
and Mrs. Brooks. Do you remember them?
Yes, I do.
They were really, really good leaders, and they really wanted a lot for the kids. And many of the students were going to insurance companies. It was
mm-hmm.
really a big deal at that time. And so when the GM job became an opportunity, they wanted to send me. So back then, they used to have the person represented from each of the high schools for shorthand and typing.
Right.
And there was usually two representatives to go. Well, I won both. And so I represented both categories. And that happened around the same time I was interviewing at General Motors at the tech center in Warren. And I interviewed for the position, and I got it. And I was in the newsletter as soon as I started there promoting my little trophies and everything. And Mrs. Newber and Mrs. Brooks were so proud of me. They were like second mothers, honestly. They followed me, and I was really tired of my family moved to the west side of Detroit. We lived on the north end,
mm-hmm.
but we moved to the west side during the senior year. But I wanted to be with my friends, and it was before it was a requirement that you go to school in your own district.
Right.
So my parents allowed me to take three buses to get to Pershing. And I would hang out with my friends, and then I had three more buses from 7 Mile and Ryan to get to 12 Mile and Mound Road. And I'm telling you, John, along the way, the habit that I had encountered with my ability to go from one place to the other, the bus drivers expected me and would wait for me.
Mm-hmm.
When I got to 8 Mile in Van Dyke, I had to take a suburban bus,
right?
You know, to get down to 12 Mile Road, but there was a hamburger joint right there on the corner. And this guy would make hamburgers and stuff for me every day. And the bus drivers would wait for me. They would drop me off at locations so that I wouldn't have to walk across a busy road. And when I think about all of the favor that I had from people expecting me, and, you know, a lot of your attitude and behavior, you want people to remember positive things about you if you can versus the negative. Both get attention, but I wanted to garner the more favorable position of you know, having a level of consistency. And you know, my parents had big expectations. You know, they wanted me to be the best that I could be, and you know, don't go out there and get yourself in trouble, and don't do this and don't do that. And so, you know, you probably realized from that time too, you know, a lot of us had parents where the mother was at home all the time and dad
exactly.
was out working.
Exactly.
And so sometimes I would get a treat, and my father, who worked the second shift at Chrysler, he worked at the Jefferson plant on the assembly line.
Mm-hmm.
And because I was out of school like around noonish, he didn't have to be at work until around 2:30 or 3 or something, as I recall. And he would drive to the high school to pick me up. Sometimes my mom would be with him. And when mom was with him, she had lunch. And so I would get a lunch. No, my favorite. It was salmon croquettes. I love them today, too. But my mom would make that for me and make a sandwich. And, you know, they'd drive me to the tech center, and then they say, have a nice day, and they would leave. So my mom never drove. She was the stay-at-home mom. And so when I got out of work, I would just take 3 more buses home. And people go like, oh, my God, you take 9 buses a day? And I said, oh, yes. I mean, I guess I had the willpower and the initiative to want to do it, because when I think about how crazy that is today, I mean,
you couldn't do it today. You couldn't do it today.
I don't know if I could do it today, because it would be such an anomaly, you know.
Exactly.
But it was the best year of my life, because once I finished my co-op program, I almost needed a work permit to work for General Motors, because I was just turning 16 years old. And so by the time I would start to work for them, I would be 16 and did not require a work permit. And so I worked in various departments. And, you know, I was a person who loved to dress. So I would mm-hmm. wear a nice knit outfits with little kitten heels. And I thought I was cute, actually.
That's the Detroit in you.
That's the Detroit in me. You're right. And so I go to work every day, and I worked in all these different departments. I never worked in a factory. It was always in the offices.
Mm-hmm.
And so after I got ready to graduate from high school, I never will forget, the personnel director called me in and told me, he says, you know, I'm really proud of you. He says, you've done really good this senior year, because I worked 4 hours a day, and I went to school the other 4
mm-hmm.
hours.
Mm-hmm.
But they paid me half the salary of a brand new hire.
What?
And I had my own Blue Cross Blue Shield card. You couldn't tell me anything. I remember telling my dad, take me off of your insurance and save the money. Here, I got my own card now. So he was like, what? And then after I graduated from high school, I really wanted to go to college. There was no other family members who had attended college. And so, but I really wanted to go. I felt like I was smart enough and I could do that. It was just like, where are you going to get the money from?
So you stayed at home at Wayne State, right?
Yeah, well, I did. But the reason that I did is because the same HR director said to me after my year was gone and I was graduating from high school, he says, we'd like to hire you full time. And I said, I want to go to college. And he says, I'm going to talk to you right now like you're my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to take this job. And he says, and let me help you understand something. We're going to pay for your education.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you'll have to go at night, but it's okay, because after this is all over, you won't have any student loans, and they will. And so it was quite enticing. And so I did. I started at the community college at Wayne, and then I went to Wayne State University. And along the way, you know, I tried U of M Dearborn. You know, I was just kind of I called myself a professional student. I always wanted to get educated, and I was trying to settle into what I wanted to be when I grow up, if you will, because by this time I was just turning 17. And so I continued to stay there, and, you know, it took me some years to get my undergrad degree. But it was something that was a part of me, and it's what I always did. And so when I graduated, I was like, what now? And so I said, well, I might as well go get my master's degree. And, of course, they were still paying for it.
Okay.
They paid for that as well. I grew up at GM. I got educated while working at GM. I didn't have any student loans. I never got laid off, John. I worked there for 32 years. And I mean to tell you, I remember going through strike lines you know, picketers being out there, and, you know, they walk across real slow so you can't drive. I was petrified. And guess what? I was driving a 1970 Volkswagen, powder blue. I had a car payment of $52.92 a month. I never will forget it was my first car. And until I could, you know, grow up and buy me a bigger car, that's mm-hmm. what I drove. And it was just such the ironies of the path of my career and how I got to where I got. It's just been amazing. But the co-op experience was good. It led me right into a full-time job. And so I've never had any other job in my life. I've never been unemployed in my life. I don't know what the inside of an unemployment office is. That's not a brag. Right. That's just is what it is, you know. And so it's just really been a charmed and blessed life.
You spent 32 years at GM. What was your last position prior to you leaving?
I was the manager in charge of all of the fasteners, things that hold things together, whether they were made of steel or plastic. And I was the commodity manager. Mm-hmm. So I was a global person, and I traveled. You know, I spent a lot of time in Germany and, you know, teaching other people what we do and creating an environment where other divisions of buyers came in and ended up working for me. And I was in charge of the whole brand new idea of this department of what would centralization look like. So the good news is that nobody had ever done it before, so there was no measurement stick for me. And the other good news was that the people who were buyers at other divisions were people that I knew, whether they came from truck plant in Pontiac or whether they were in Lansing or whether they were in Flint. We all knew each other, and they were really quite pleased for, you know, my opportunity to be the manager. And I would always tell them, I said, any one of us could have ended up being manager. It just happened to be me. So let's kind of work together and make sure that, you know, we create something for others to see that is unimaginable, because who are the experts? We are. And so it really worked out well, because I work in teams. You know, I happen to be the boss. I happen to know what I'm doing, but I don't need to be bossy to get it done, if you will. You know what I mean?
I understand.
And so it was a really great experience.
This is In Black America. We'll be back with more of our conversation in a moment. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and we're speaking with Jeanette N. Abraham, founder, president, and CEO of JMA Global LLC. Ms. Abraham, talk to us about Charles O'Brien.
Oh. Now, he was an amazing Irishman. You know, I'm a black female. He is watching me. You know, I always tell people, you never know who's paying attention to you. And so here he is at the General Motors lobby, and he's in the Chrysler lobby, he's in the Ford lobby. And he actually said to me that, you know, out of all the places that I go, and, you know, we run into each other as salesmen in all of these lobbies, people will say, so-and-so makes me wait in the lobby forever, never calls me in, this person that. They say they were going to do this. They reneged on it and didn't follow through, blah, blah, blah. He says, but one thing I have to say about you is I've never heard anybody say negative things about you. You do what you say you're going to do, and you walk the talk. And so I was, you know, happy with the compliment. And so just not paying any attention to anything else, just like, okay, cool, that's what I want people to think about me. And so one day I went out, I took a vacation day, and I went to Ford Motor, the Wixom facility and procurement there. They had a director position open, and I wanted to go and interview for it. And so I took a day off, and I went. And then I came back to work the next day, and somehow or another, the director of my department found out that I was on an interview. And so, you know, his secretary called me in, and so she says, you know, Mr. Thompson would like to see you. And I'm thinking, what the heck does he want to see me for? So I go in there, and, you know, this is what we used to call Mahogany Row. It was like all wood walls. It's where all the big shots sat. Mm-hmm. They had little buttons by their desk, and so you could come in, and they would push the button to close the door. Nobody had to get up. And so I sat there and I looked at him. I said, so what can I do for you today? He says, well, I hear you think Ford has a better idea. And I just bust out laughing. I said, how did you know? I said, I was on my own time on vacation. He said, yes, I know. But, you know, we want you to stay, and we don't want you to take any other position because we have plans for you. And so I was like, okay, cool. And so I moved on, and they had a big reorganization in the mid-'80s, and I ended up working in Flint. And Mr. O'Brien was in the lobby one day, and he said, I'd like to know if you're interested in having another opportunity outside of here. Would you ever leave GM? And I had to really think about that, because most of us get into an environment, and once we feel safe and we have seniority and you're accustomed to getting your paycheck two times a month, and, you know, like, why would you move and go anywhere? But you have to learn at the same time that there is a life outside of what you do. You just have to sometimes jump and not be afraid to go, because without an opportunity to leap to something else, you'll never know what it would be like. And even though I was full of trepidation, I continued to listen to Chuck O'Brien, because he kept sharing these little nuggets with me that made me think. And so we continued to talk, and then I did a lot of coordination with minority companies and majority companies so that they could help the minority companies become more progressive, hire more people, and all of that. And one of the companies that I had pulled together, I asked Chuck O'Brien if he would take a look at their books. And then I went to the minority partner, and I says, I want to help you, but we've got to let somebody in to take a look at things, and this is what I'm trying to do. So he listened, and he says, okay, Jeanette, I'll do it. And, I mean, within days, like, seemed like 48 hours, it was like a coup. They had gone in and come up with an agreement, and this was a done deal. And so Chuck O'Brien says, okay, we did it. And I did it because you asked me to do it. And I says, oh, just like that? And he said, yeah, just like that. And so, unfortunately, the minority owner of the company was sick and really hadn't paid attention to going to the doctor or anything, ended up passing away with cancer. And but he treated me like I was his daughter. I mean, I would mentor his company, and he would show me how to read a blueprint. And when the grinding is on here, and here's where this finish, and here's the tolerances, you know, he was just going through everything. And you just never know, John, why you're getting information, because everything that you hear today may not be for you today. And you have to be resourceful enough to treat your brain like a library shelf and just research things that you've heard and things that you know and use them when they're best able to be used. And so Chuck O'Brien said to me after he passed away and we were at the funeral, and I spoke on behalf of GM and talked about the integrity of the company and the kind of man he was and everything. And so when I got off of the podium there speaking, Chuck O'Brien came over to me and he says, I'm going to call you. I want to speak to you. And so his wife later told me that when I was speaking, he said to her, she's the one. Like, he picked me to be his partner in business because of my work ethic and the things that I had done. And then he enticed me further by saying, this opportunity is yours if you want it, because I'm not asking anybody else. What do you do with that?
I know, that's right.
You go, wow. So I did. I believe intuitively that things that are for me may not be for everybody. I feel when it's right or when I should lay back and if I should go or no go. And so I told him I'm going to need some time, you know, just to pray about this.
But
and
you
so
needed
3 days.
But you needed more than time. You need to come up with $1 million, didn't you?
Well, of course I did, and that was the scary part. But I didn't know that at the time. I was like, I wasn't even that far ahead of the game. I just said, wow, okay. And so then after I made up my mind and said, okay, I'll do this, what's the next step?
Mm-hmm.
And then it hit me. I was like, well, what is it going to cost me to buy into the business? And he says, well, whatever we pay the widow out will be your buy-in amount. And it was $1 million, to your point. And I was like, am I $1 million credit worthy person? Heck no. You know, who's going to give me $1 million? But I'm talking about favor once again, you know, just You know, I'm obedient and strict with myself, and I try to follow through, or I try to walk the talk and do the things that I say I'm going to do, because my dad always told me that, you know, if you give your word is your bond. You must do this, you must do that. And so those things still today ring in my ear. But I go to that bank, and they tell me to listen, come in on the side door. This is in Birmingham. Mm-hmm. And they come in through the side door. There's a parking lot back there. You know, the attendant is back there. Just tell them you have a meeting with us. And I'm thinking, nobody goes in the bank at the side door. But I go into the side door. They say, go in, take the elevator to the second floor. Somebody will be waiting for you. Mm. Well, Chuck O'Brien was in there, too, because all along he's orchestrating my coming out, if you will. And unbeknownst to me, because it was area that I had never been in that aspect where I was the candidate for something. Mm-hmm. And so I get up there. The receptionist stands up. She points down. She says, go down here, go to the right. And so the branch manager stood there in the doorway, and he waved his hand. She said, that's him. He's waving his hand. So I go down there. And there, everybody's smiling. Can I get you a cup of coffee? And I'm like, no, I don't want anything. I told the people at work I was going to a meeting, you know. So I get in there, and he starts smiling, and he says, we've heard so much about you, and we really respect Chuck O'Brien so much. And, you know, everything he touches is like the Midas touch, and we believe in him, and he believes in you, so we believe in you. Mm-hmm. And we've decided to give you the $1 million that you need to buy into the business. Well, it was 51% of the business, right? Mm-hmm. My knees were shaking like crazy.
I knew they were.
I was like, did this guy just say he's going to give me $1 million? You know, it's better than the lottery. And so I'm sitting down, and my knees are literally shaking, and I'm like, oh, my God. And so I was really cool, and they said, well, you know, is everything all right? And I said, yeah. And so the branch manager said, he said, listen, you got to do me a favor. I said, what is that? He says, you know the application that we gave you? And I said, yes. And he says, I'm going to need you to fill it out because, you know, my ASS is going to be grass if somebody finds out I gave you $1 million, you didn't fill out an application. And so, you know, I said, yes, of course, I'll get it done. And I did. And I'm telling you, it has just been the experience of my life. So 1 year after I'm there, you know, Chuck is teaching me things. He's teaching me how to read a balance sheet. He's telling me what the industry standards are. He's telling me what percentage of value and profit that you need to make on a company in order to call yourself viable. He's showing me what to look at, how to hire people, what to do, this, that, and the other. And so one day he said, look at your balance sheet and tell me where you spend most of your money. I said, wow. I said, I spend annually $1.5 million just on warehousing and distribution. Mm. And he said, so you could do that, right?
Jeanette Abraham, founder, president, and CEO of JMA Global, LLC. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
You are listening to Ebony Spectrum here on WRCT Pittsburgh. And let's look at some of the things in the news this week.
recent interview, Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders suggested that her administration rejected a course on African American history to prevent students from being taught hatred of America.
There's a little bit of controversy right now. There's an accusation that the Arkansas Education Department removed credit for controversial AP African American Studies course. Let me just read to you what the NAACP said and let you respond. They said the Arkansas State Conference of the NAACP is appalled at the recent decision of Arkansas Department of Education to make a hasteful decision at the final hour to do away with AP African American Studies. Is that really what happened there?
Absolutely not. And one of the things that we have talked about so much, and Dana, I think the point that you made a minute ago about the staggering numbers that we're seeing across this country, we've got to get back to the basics of teaching math, of teaching reading, writing, and American history. And we cannot perpetuate a lie to our students and push this propaganda leftist agenda, teaching our kids to hate America and hate one another. It's one of the reasons that we put into law banning things like indoctrination and CRT. We want our kids to receive a quality education, and we want to make sure that every student has access to it and a pathway to prosperity. And that's exactly what we're doing here in the state of Arkansas.
It was earlier this month when the Arkansas Department of Education gave 2 days' notice that the advanced placement course on African American Studies would no longer be accepted for credit. The Sanders administration also said the state will not cover the $90 for the final exam, even though it covers that amount for other AP courses. Listen, I'm looking at this, Dr. Malvo, and I'm thinking, what is going on here? She talks about teaching math and she talks about teaching English, but it doesn't sound like she wants to teach any history.
Well, she doesn't mind teaching European history. The state of Arkansas does have a course in AP European history that they do pay the $90 for students to take the exam on. So if you want to learn about America, why would you give preference to teaching European history except for your own hypocrisy? Sarah Huckabee Sanders came into office when she was elected talking smack about a critical race theory, of which she doesn't know what it is. But she said, we can't have critical race theory. 44 states, my sister, have actually introduced legislation to keep from teaching anything that has to do with race. Only about 28, I forget the number, but 20-some states have passed. But 44 states, that's the majority of states. What's happened essentially is that the conservative right has taken over language. So critical race theory is a buzzword for race awareness. No one is teaching a legal concept in K through 12 or even beyond. This is simply hatred and not wanting people to know the truth. What's ironic about this, in Elaine, Arkansas, 200 black men were lynched simply because they attempted to come together. They were sharecroppers and they wanted to get a better price for their produce. So they tried to come together and organize. Someone spread the lie that a white communist was organizing them. They were organizing themselves in a black church. 200 people were lynched. No, she doesn't want young people to know that story. But young people will surprise you, because young white people want to know the stories too. They want to know what the origins of this are. I chair Push Excel, which is the education arm of Rainbow Push, Reverend Jackson's organization. And we have two young people who come to talk to us, brilliant young, they were high school seniors last year. And one of those young ladies said, I think it's as important for me to learn about what happened in Chicago with the Red Summer of 1919, where people were lynched and shot and all that, as it is for me to learn algebra. That's what many of our young people are thinking. I want to know the truth. But Sarah Huckabee Sanders and her ilk do not want to know the truth. No one is saying, it hurts your feelings. Being enslaved hurts somebody's feelings.
Right.
So talk about hurting feelings. It's ridiculous. She's just wrong, but she's been wrong. I mean, she's a spawn of wrong. Let me stop.
You know, we talk about learning history. That's what Dr. Malvo was talking about. Renita, when we talk about learning history, there are a lot of people who are learning history on their own in freedom schools across the country, setting up in their own right these schools where people can learn. It is a shame that it would have to come to that. But when we look at solutions like that, you know, what are your thoughts about these types of schools and the fact that different communities across the country have had to take education into their own hands?
Well, as a Black person, you know, I'm not familiar with any other Black families who ever believed that all of the education you would need about Black history you would receive in schools. I mean, this is terrible, obviously, but I don't think that anybody was under the illusion that you would receive proper Black history education just from school. We've always had to know that. We have had to talk to our elders. We've had to talk to folks in our family to get the true education that we need. Now, this is interesting for a few reasons, because some schools in Arkansas have said that they are going to teach AP Black history, regardless of what the state says. And so I'm glad to see these schools stand up and say, hey, we're going to do what's best for these students. We want them to be able to compete in the modern workforce. And a part of that is knowing and understanding the history of this country and understanding different perspectives just as much as it is knowing math and knowing science. And Arkansas, out of all places, should be willing to teach AP history. This may be history that maybe Sarah Huckabee Sanders does not know, but she probably needs to learn some history, because Arkansas was at the center of being one of the first to integrate schools in 1957. So they have lots of actual history right there. I would suspect living history that they really should be teaching. And so, to your point, the more that they try to tell these students what they can't learn, all it's going to do is drive those students to want to learn more on their own. And I think that all of this that is happening across the country is just going to be, it's going to be reminiscent of what happened in the 80s when the government started putting the parental advisory on CDs. And all that did was made teenagers want to listen to that music more.
You know, Dr. Dubinga, I did a search when I put in the word slave earlier today, and it popped up. Did slaves learn a lot or have a hard time while they were slaves? Because these are the discussions that are happening across the country, whether or not slavery was good or bad. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are about the fact that you really can't get around teaching history altogether with keeping major parts of it out in telling the story. How do you think teachers can get around it, or can that even actually happen?
Well, first of all, you know, somebody who does work in schools across the country, charter, public, and private schools, and have been doing this for over 20 years, I'm very adamant about the fact that teaching accuracy is not activism. I had a situation where a white teacher told me she was doing a project on African civilizations. This was in Maryland, and the kids were all in majority white school. The kids were all involved and active about the project. But when they submitted the final pictures that they did of the African kings, they were all white. And the teacher was shocked, and she asked, why did they do this? And so it's because the students said they didn't want to get in trouble by being viewed as being racist. So this idea that whiteness is the center is causing a true distortion of history that is throwing everybody off. And one of the things I talk about in my students at American University, they get so angry when they find out the truth, when they find out the real things that have happened that they were never taught in school. I was showing pictures of postcards of the lynchings that were happening back in the days. And one student started getting really upset in school because she was like, wait a minute, that's my street. Like, that's the block I grew up on, and she never knew that history. So every single day, and when we deny these students their history, when they find out the truth, they get really upset. Axios did a study that said majority of white Republican students want to know the true history. But one of the things I talk about in my book, Lies About Black People, I have some poetry in there, and some of the lines that I have in there, when I'm talking about us, I'm like, yo, where were your laws when I was learning about me? When my history books thought that I only came from slavery, when my mathematics classes left out Black contributions, when my science classes left out our contributions to evolution, when our history classes talk about America's hopes and intentions, but didn't lift my hopes by teaching me about Black inventions. You don't think that I felt guilty like 3/5 of a man when y'all taught me that I was only civilized when y'all brought me to this land? So really, at the end of the day, we're doing all of this stuff to protect white kids, but white kids can handle the truth. But those who are not white, those who are particularly Black and brown, we've always been taught negative history about our culture and society, but nobody gave a damn about us. And so the fact of the matter is, we gotta speak up. And lastly, in Florida, you also see that they got rid of AP psychology because of its LGBTQ issues that they had.
Yes,
white parents out there who aren't speaking up right now, your whole school system, your college aspirations for your children are being jeopardized when you're not speaking up for us now. It's just a matter of time before they come for the other courses that your kids are interested in. So you might as well join us now, because it's just a matter of time before your whole college aspirations for your kids get messed up and there are no AP classes that teach about anything.
Dr. DeBing, I wanted to stay with you for a moment because I am sure that as a teacher, you hear from other teachers. What's the sense around how they're feeling about these limitations and the 44 states that have passed legislation about AP? And is there any fear or sense of fear in them? Because there have been teachers that have lost their jobs for showing a movie, for example, that was on a list of approved movies. What is your gathering of information in terms of how teachers are feeling these days where you are?
There's absolutely fear and anger. I was in Florida recently working with teachers and librarians, and there's places I'm speaking, they're crying, they're angry. And, you know, of course they're angry and concerned about job loss and the like, but they're also literally concerned about their students and what they can't share with them. And it's not just these red states. You know, in Maryland, I had a teacher say that now that parents feel so emboldened, a teacher literally came up to him and said, can you not teach about the bad guys like Malcolm X? Teach about the good guys like Dr. King. And felt emboldened to say those things. And these are in schools where teachers were teaching the history regularly with no problems. So all of a sudden, they don't feel like they're being supported. In my book, I have a whole chapter on critical race theory. As Dr. Malvo said, it's not being taught in schools. But one of the things that teachers are always saying, if we're teaching kids to stand up to bullies, we got to stand up to the bullies too. And that's why more teachers are speaking out and protesting, and they need our support.
Renita, what are some of the solutions here? How do we go about making sure that that history is taught? As you already said, it was already taught when you were growing up, and it's safe to assume that a lot of people would understand that you have to kind of fill in some blanks. But what do we do with these school systems that have such a large gap in the teaching process?
Well, as a former elected official, I'm going to talk to you about what people can do from the political side. And so that is, number one, make sure you're voting and you're knowing when you have school board races, because those are the folks whose actual job it is to stand up and make sure that the curriculum reflects what should be taught. You also want to, and those folks also, by the way, help in selecting the superintendent for every county. And so the superintendent is the person who ultimately is controlling what curriculum looks like within school districts. And so everybody has got to make sure to start paying attention to these school board races, make sure that if you don't see what you want to see represented, and that somebody who's willing to stand up and say that we need accurate Black history taught, then you yourself consider running for school board. The other thing that folks can do as well is make sure to stop voting for people who want to just highlight this issue. Because at the end of the day, fighting over what is going to be taught in schools does not allow you to pay your bills better. These are not the basic things that should be at the top priority of what any elected official is working on. And so what this is really just another cultural war niche issue that the Republicans are using, hoping to really gin up their base, for the base of the folks that actually care about this. And to get them out to vote. And so at the end of the day, every person who votes and pays taxes should be mad about this, because this is not what you send elected officials to do, which is ruin education for children. That's not what you vote for. I don't believe anybody votes for that, and nobody votes for this to be anybody's top priority.
Dr. Malvo, do you expect to hear this particular topic, I would imagine, on Thursday's debates?
It will come up, absolutely, because it's become a wedge issue and it shouldn't be. Renita is right. We don't have elected officials. These are people are not experts in any kind of education, but it'll come up because they've turned it into a wedge issue, because Ron DeSantis has made it an issue in Florida, where basically they've taken away the AP. I have a former faculty member who actually took a job, I begged him not to, at the University of Florida, and they sent him a letter after he accepted the job saying he can't use the term diversity, equity, or inclusion in his classroom. This is an ethnic studies professor. I don't know how he's going to be able to do his degree and to get, but he had to sign this piece of paper. They gave him a huge raise, so I kept saying, "Dude, you're not going to be happy there." But I hooked him up. He can come back in a year if he wants to.
And I keep that door open.
I bet that he will want to. You know, the thing that's really going on here is that they changed this Chris Ralph, I think his name is Chris Rufo. He's among those who basically are fighting against affirmative action, bringing lawsuits against private companies who want to do affirmative action type initiatives, and now dealing with the whole education piece and talking about what can be taught in schools. Renita's right. We have to revive our Saturday schools. Parents have to do what they're doing, because was an African philosopher who said, you know, you cannot let the master... or you can't let the oppressor teach the children how to think. understand that we don't run school boards. We may be on them, you know. But my last thing I would say, though, is I am very frustrated with academics, with professors of ethnic studies, Black studies, Latino studies. Those are the folks who need to be out there. I am frustrated with these Black folks, even K through 12 teachers. Now, they have a lot to lose, but why can't we educators push back on these people and say, oh, hell no? I mean, we're the ones who are in the classrooms. We see the young people. We see what they want to know. Omokongo talked about the young lady, said, that's my street. She had to be totally stricken to realize that lynching took place on her street. Mm. So if educators are not willing to stand up, ignorant people, Sarah Huckabee Sanders probably couldn't read a curriculum, much less adhere to one. But if ignorant people take over education, they'll teach what basically promotes their myth. And the only reason why we use terms like white supremacy, which I try not to use, is because a system was set up to reinforce the inferiority of Black people. And that included the education system. We cannot have that. We must fight back on that. And professors, teachers, you see this day to day. Y'all have to be part of the resistance.
Yeah, and you're right. The teachers are in the classrooms. They have the power. They're the ones who are actually in that moment teaching, and they are in charge of what they actually end up saying in that classroom. I also think the parents have a responsibility in that, too. Black August. Have you ever heard of it?
They will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
While many of y'all who are about that social justice life might say yes, I'd argue that plenty more folks have no clue what I'm talking about. Today's baggage, the activism of Black August. It's summertime. And to some, this might mean beach days and barbecues. But to others, August is a month of remembrance. Black August began in the 1970s to honor the life and legacy of incarcerated Black revolutionary George Jackson, who was killed during a rebellion in the San Quentin Correctional Facility, his brother, Jonathan Jackson, and other activists who advocated for prisoners' rights, giving way to the rise of the prison abolition movement. And while Black August is observed in social justice circles, its message of Black power, resistance, and activism is critical to our existence in this country and should be more widely celebrated. But miss me with the whitewashing. So why August, you say? Let's take a look at the month throughout history. The year 1619 is tremendously significant to African Americans because it's when the first enslaved Africans arrived in America. The date was August 20th, 1619, to be exact. Over a century later, there was the Haitian Revolution. On August 14th, 1791, Toussaint Louverture led an army of enslaved people, which ultimately resulted in Haiti becoming the first Black republic in the world. Then there was Nat Turner's Rebellion, which popped off in August 1831. Overseas, Britain's Slavery Abolition Act, which abolished slavery in most of its colonies, took effect on August 1st, 1834. But the legislation was first passed on August 28th, 1833. Which brings us to another monumental date in Black history. Ava DuVernay highlighted August 28th in a film for the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture back in 2016. August 28th is significant because it's the date of Emmett Till's murder in 1955, MLK's I Have a Dream speech and the March on Washington, which took place in 1963, and Hurricane Katrina became a Category 5 storm and hit land in 2005. And in 2008, Barack Obama became the first African-American presidential nominee.
I accept your nomination for presidency of the United States.
Many prominent Black figures like Henrietta Lacks, Marcus Garvey, and Chairman Fred Hampton were born in August, and many of them died in this month too. And now back to the origins of Black August.
freedom fighters, resistance organizations, Black liberation organizations have really been taking the month of August, not just to honor the memory of George Jackson's life, but really to challenge the multiple systems that killed him. The systems that continue to criminalize Black bodies, the systems that continue to imprison and enslave us, the systems that continue to render our communities unhealthy and over-policed.
Brittany Packnett Cunningham is an activist, educator, writer, and host of the podcast Undistracted.
And just like Juneteenth, Black August is something that is coming more and more into the American consciousness. I don't get mad at Black folks when they don't know about Black August. There is an investment by the powers that be who would much rather maintain white supremacy culture and dominant culture status quo. And that is much more easily done when Black folks don't understand what we are capable of and can't see the evidence of how we've been freeing ourselves for generations.
Before we get too far ahead of ourselves, it's important to note that Black August is not Black History Month. After all, Black History Month was started by Carter G. Woodson and was initially Negro History Week. Its aim was to promote the study of African Americans and their contributions to this nation. Packnett Cunningham says that both Black August and Black History Month are distinct but critical.
Black August challenges us to look at the systems that rendered Black people silent in the first place. Black August really pushes us to say there is a reason why we have to create these distinctive moments and distinctive opportunities for us to shine the light on ourselves and each other. So how do we not only shine the light during a Black History Month, but how do we challenge the systems that silence us during a Black August?
And many of the ideologies that shape radical Black thought that were critical to Black August were conceived by Black women. Like Angela Davis, the revered political activist who aided George Jackson's escape attempt. Or Assata Shakur. And Audre Lorde, who Packnett Cunningham reminds us has said that self-care is an act of political warfare.
And when Audre Lorde says things like that in her poetry, in her writing, in her oration, it helps us remove the stigma of whole Black personhood, right? That I am here to find joy just as much as I am here to engage in struggle. That we engage in struggle because it is necessary, not because it is inherent to who we are. That we are deserving of full lives and we are deserving of preserved lives. And because those lives are Black lives, that they stand up against the status quo that is indeed, that makes all of us a political revolution. We've got filmmakers, we've got photographers, we've got folks who challenge the very notion of what it means to be Black, even for Black people. And that's the provocative thing that we cannot forget about Black August.
Audre Lorde was a Black queer woman and an activist. She, along with revolutionaries like Marsha P. Johnson, shaped our understanding of Black liberation, as did James Baldwin and Bayard Rustin. Today, many would argue that Black liberation has become more inclusive.
So liberation isn't about just being liberated from whiteness and white supremacy. It's about being liberated to live in your full and complete truth without the gaze of anyone.
Danielle Moody is a Black queer woman who is also the host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. She says that the idea of Black liberation has shifted.
When I think of Black liberation now, I think about the liberation of Black trans women. I think about the inclusivity in which we use the term Black, right? And we think about liberation and that and what safety looks like. Because then it was trying to just be safe from the police, to be safe, you know, in our homes. When I think about safety now, right? I mean, to be safe in my skin, to be safe in my body, to be safe how I show up. And as a Black queer woman, for me, that means the ability to show up as my full and complete self.
While both Moody and Brittany Packnett Cunningham believe that Black August should gain more awareness beyond social justice circles, they also caution against the observance becoming too mainstream or whitewashed.
It's so difficult to maintain integrity of these movements and these experiences because anytime that things become mainstream, right, like Juneteenth is now going to be a federal holiday, right? But at the same time that you want to make Juneteenth a federal holiday, you also don't want people to understand the context in which Juneteenth became a day of recognition in the first goddamn place.
In the centuries since the first Africans were brought to America, we've had to fight for our liberation every step of the way. And today in the 2020s, we still fight for our full and uninhibited liberation, which includes voting rights, access to health care, and education, among other issues. But is Black liberation an ideology that is at the very core of Black August an achievable goal?
I have to believe Black liberation is an achievable goal. That kind of critical hope is what helps you keep going when it's difficult. I have to believe that Harriet Tubman felt like Black liberation was an achievable goal. I have to believe that Fannie Lou Hamer believed that Black liberation was a goal. I have to believe that Ida B. Wells knew that Black liberation was possible. And so if they can believe that, then I can most certainly believe that. It's hope that looks at the evidence of Black freedom fighters throughout generations who have made us more free today than we were yesterday. And that evidence, that data lets me know that it is possible.
Indeed, Black liberation is still the end goal. And that means working and fighting for a future when all Black lives matter. While Black August dwells in social justice circles and is very much preserved by activists, it is imperative that we amplify the message of Black power and keep the revolutionary flame burning, now and forever.
Hey y'all, what's up? It's Friday, so I'm gonna keep it Black, but I'm gonna keep it brief. I am back, everyone. Yes, yes, you are all welcome. I genuinely hope you enjoyed my substitute teachers, but it's time to get back to your regularly scheduled programming. So let's get into it. Black people will do anything, and they ought to be shamed, but they not. If you haven't been tapped in, then you might not know that apparently the movie The Blind Side was all a lie. The story we've come to know, based on the life of retired football star Michael Orr, was actually manufactured by the Tui family and turned into an Oscar-winning film. Why y'all like to award Oscars to movies about Black people needing white people is another conversation for another day. The movie had a great concept and could have been based on a great story had it depicted Michael Orr's own incredible journey from the Tennessee foster care system to playing D1 football at Ole Miss. But instead, it's mostly about Leanne Tui and her white saviorism, except in real life, it more so seems like she was hitting a lick instead of saving somebody. While the film rests on this act of altruism of adopting Michael Orr into the Tui family, in real life, these people coerced him into signing a conservatorship, putting them in complete control of his money. See, the Tuis did not take Michael in until he was 18 years old, which is past the time of legal adoption. This was also the year before his senior year in high school, which is around the time high school athletes commit to collegiate teams. And if you recall from the movie, the Tuis themselves were Ole Miss alum. So the NCAA said it would be best for Michael to be legally attached to them if he was going to play at Ole Miss, so they didn't seem like boosters. And I'm not talking about figuring out which mom is bringing the Gatorades to which game. I'm talking about boosters that act as third parties to financially support athletes or funneling athletes into teams. And when the Tuis brought the conservatorship papers to Michael, they explained it away to him as something like an adoption to satisfy the NCAA's requirements. And what we also remember from the film is that Michael was behind the learning curve. Having been in the foster care system for 11 years, families and teachers kept passing him on to the next person, and nobody made it a point to share that he needed help until he got into this Christian school. I say all that to say, even if they thought they could manipulate Michael into thinking this was an adoption, why did they go and tell everybody else it was an adoption? There's a lot to unpack here. Number one, Black people have been tricked into signing some shit under the pretense it was some other shit for decades following the Reconstruction, because up until the Reconstruction, it was illegal for us to read. Black people have been conned into signing their life away to work peonage debt they did not owe. Conned out of their land, conned out of their uteri, conned into syphilis experiments because they didn't understand the papers in front of them. Number two, you wanted everybody to believe you adopted him because you wanted to be perceived as a good white person while actively practicing being a bad one. Because according to Michael, he was coerced into signing away the right to negotiate contracts to the Tuis, who were also then able to make a deal for the film where they and their two biological children each made $225,000 and a 2.5% share of net profits from the film, a film that ended up grossing over $300 million and $14,000 apiece from the book. And what's crazy is that you use this story as a method to further justify this conservatorship by painting the picture that Michael could not take care of himself without you. There's a scene where the Tui's youngest son, SJ, is supposedly teaching Mike how to play football with food condiments, when in fact, Michael had been playing the sport for years and had already been recognized for his talent. There's also a scene where Leanne shows Mike his room and he says, "Oh, I've never had a bed before." Never? Never is nuts. But the guys of white saviorship will do it for y'all every time. It's your blueprint. It's your modus operandi, if you will. The concept was popularized from a poem written by Rudyard Kipling about the Philippine-American War, entitled The White Man's Burden. But white saviorhood was in fact the key tenet and a justification for slavery from the jump, suggesting that Blacks in Africa were going to hell in a handbasket, didn't have on no clothes or civilization, so they needed white people to save their souls. Dang it, I forgot my Bible. I ain't never seen that in the book. And why are we talking about it? That's exactly the shit that Santa's over there in Florida and in people over happening in Arkansas are talking about, spewing lies, saying the slaves learn new skills. The fuck was a resource poor society gonna teach an agricultural society about agriculture? That's why you went over there and got them in the first place, because y'all couldn't do what y'all was asking them to do. Shut the fuck up. Anyway, the poem's rhetoric became synonymous with imperialism and served as a bomb to soothe white people's egos as they raped and pillaged foreign lands for profit. And in keeping with the same ideology, Leanne and Fran said, let's say this big black boy who just happens to be an extremely talented athlete and funnel him through our alma mater. And because we invested money into getting him there, we feel completely entitled to trick him into signing away his rights. Oh my God, it's the philanthropy for us, really. Her husband, Sean, too, we had the nerve to say the other day that they were devastated to hear of a lawsuit and that it's upsetting to think that they will ever make money off any of their kids. Huh? That's what you did. And it's interesting to me because if you know making money off your kids is bad enough to make that statement of deflection, why would you do it in the first place? Y'all be so quick to say, I'm not racist, I'm not a bigot, I'm not exploiting a black body just like they did in the olden days. It's just a conservatorship. Stop playing on his top and run Big Mike his coins. Oh, y'all got your shirts yet? Y'all got your hats? They're going up. Check your emails for the code.
Thanks for listening. WRCT Pittsburgh. Consolidation is up next.
Pose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Just days before the first votes in the 2024 election, which will come in the Republican primary, specifically in the Iowa caucus on Monday, Martin Luther King Day, we have a whole bunch of election-related events to discuss. It includes a town hall. It includes a candidate dropping out, Chris Christie, and it includes the final, quote, debate, although there were only two people on the stage. This was a CNN-hosted debate with Jake Tapper and Dana Bash. The debate was only including Ron DeSantis and Nikki Haley, and it got very, very ugly. And also, it serves as a super useful reminder when we look at it in concert with Chris Christie dropping out, in concert with Donald Trump's town hall and the questions he was asked in the town hall. It's an incredible reminder of the deranged and extreme ideological place where the modern Republican Party finds itself in 2024. So let's get right into it. We start with the debate. Nikki Haley and Ron DeSanctimonious, you know, the guy with the charisma. They were both asked about the recent claims by Trump's lawyers that presidential immunity could even include the assassination of a political rival if the president were not first impeached. Ron DeSantis was asked about it. Nikki Haley was asked about it. Let's look at their answers, starting with the failed Florida governor.
Let's talk about how you view the powers of the presidency, because your opponent, Donald Trump, was in court yesterday for a hearing on presidential immunity. And Governor DeSantis, I'm wondering if you agree with the argument that Donald Trump's lawyer made in court that a president should have immunity for any conduct in office, including, as the judge asked, ordering the assassination of a political rival, unless the president gets impeached and convicted by the Senate for the offense first.
Well, obviously, that attorney gave the case away on that explanation. I think the D.C. Circuit is going to rule against Donald Trump on that issue. I'm not exactly sure what the outer limits are. I don't think it's necessarily been litigated. It's not going to be an issue with me because I'm always going to follow the Constitution.
There you go. So Ron DeSantis's view is, listen, I think Trump will lose. With me, I'll follow the Constitution, so it won't even be an issue. But the critical part of it is DeSantis saying, I'm not sure what the outer limits are. Maybe a president could get away with ordering a rival assassinated. Maybe a president could not. This question served to draw a very clear contrast between the insanity of DeSantis and the relative sanity of Nikki Haley. And again, I think Chris Christie was the most sane of the Republicans running, but Nikki Haley was second to Chris Christie. And when Nikki Haley is given the opportunity to answer this question, is this, could this be real? Nikki, please, governor, ambassador, whatever they call her now, could a president order a political rival assassinated? She does the this doesn't even pass the sniff test thing. Of course they couldn't. Nikki Haley, clearly more connected, tethered to reality than Ron DeSantis.
The question was, do you agree with the argument Donald Trump's lawyer made in court that a president should have immunity for any conduct, including in ordering the assassination of a political rival, unless that president is impeached and convicted by the Senate for that offense first?
No, that's ridiculous. That's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, we need to use some common sense here. You can't go and kill a political rival and then claim, you know, immunity from a president.
All right. So she's being clear about this. Good for Nikki. On this stage, it's all about options. From the folks on this stage, Nikki Haley is the better choice. And if you came to me and you said, sir, either DeSantis or Haley will be the next president, who do you choose? I obviously choose Nikki Haley. And this contrast where DeSantis goes, well, I won't violate the Constitution. Well, that wasn't the question.